This is on July 6th, 1966. Okay.
We probably should begin by describing the subject of the book. The book you're referring to is Understanding Media. Media, as most people probably don't know, refers to all the forms of communication that are used in daily life. That is, the advertising media, the TV media, the newspapers,
comic books.
That is, media is actually a sort of Madison Avenue word, I believe. And maybe that was one of the reasons why McLuhan's use of that term might have thrown people off to begin with. Now, McLuhan is talking about all these popular forms. In other words, what's usually called the popular arts or the popular means of expression. And his idea is that this constant rain of information, information including also entertainment, which we receive through these media, change us. Now, anyone might have known that. That is, that if we keep watching movies and reading comic books, detective stories, we are changed. But his idea of our being changed is much more extreme than the ordinary one. He regards these media as, to use his term, extensions of our senses. In order to explain what the current media are doing to us, because that's what he's talking about, we have to look back to an earlier book of his called The Gutenberg Galaxy, in which he maintained that the culture of the past 500 or 600 years, that is since the Renaissance, has been determined almost entirely by the book, which is a medium too. The big change brought about from the Middle Ages, the movement into the modern world was brought about by the book. Now, the characteristic of the book is that it contains regular lines of type. As a medium, it's a
uniform
rectangular
line.
Space with lines on it, and these lines contain type, and as your eye moves back and forth from one end of the line to another, you have become an eye-extended person. Now, in the 19th century, with the invention of the telegraph, we begin to have new media, electronic media.
Well, Hal, before you go on to that, now let's get one thing straight. What was the culture that this Gutenberg galaxy finally made obsolescent? I mean, before people were so eye-oriented, how were they oriented? I mean,
they
what was
were,
the culture before that?
They were orally oriented.
So we went from an orally oriented culture
exactly.
to what was eye-oriented.
The equivalent of that...
And what does that mean in practical terms?
It means
it's
in practical...
It's an abstract statement.
Well, sure, and that's what the Gutenberg galaxy is about. That is, the changes that took place in the individual as he moved out of the oral culture into the reading or eye culture. Now, some of the changes that took place were thus. In an oral culture, somebody tells you something and you listen. Consequently, you're always in touch with people. And that's what usually called the integrated community of the earlier
immediate personal contact.
In other words, you're in a context. You as an individual are in a context. The moment you possess yourself of a book, you can go off in a corner and read it, develop yourself, and get out of touch with the rest of society. So we begin to have the conflict, according to McLuhan, between the individual and society at the beginning of the reading culture.
All right. Now, take it from the other side, Harold. how does the book, let's say, alter the writer or the poet or the person who is creating the culture? I mean, it not only works in terms of the relation of the audience to the artist, but it also works in the relation of the artist to his own output, doesn't it?
Yes. Well, of course, what would happen then would be that the poet, instead of producing something for oral recitation, would produce an image on a page. If you carry that far enough, you finally arrive at visual poetry, which we've had in the 20th century.
Yes.
Furthermore, you get a splitting of the individual. That is, you begin to get romanticism. The poet has the power of all the books that he has read accumulated within himself. He doesn't necessarily share this with the rest of the community. Consequently, he becomes an introspective personality. Or, as McLuhan says, literacy is probably the cause of schizophrenia. He begins to be, on the one hand, a citizen, on the other hand, a person of sensibility. Mm-hmm. So that the book is responsible for all of these phenomena which we find hanging over us. And of course, the big point about understanding media is that we are now departing from this unhappy state produced by the book. That is, we're going back, going forward back into a more integrated world in which we are deluged in all of our senses.
Well, now, this is a very important point, because, I mean, the conventional point of view, let's say on television or other mass media of the current day, is that they represent a threat to culture, and that essentially their value has yet to be determined and is highly suspect in many quarters. Now, what this man seems to be saying is that instead of them running us off the edge of literacy into the void of ignorance, that perhaps they're really going to reestablish certain values which once our society possessed and which were very healthy and wholesome for us, and restore these in a future world. So that, in other words, he comes out with a much more positive orientation towards current technological innovations and mass media operations than would an ordinary literary intellectual, or even perhaps a sociologist.
That's correct, except that you used the word perhaps. McLuhan doesn't deal in perhapses. He is convinced that this trend is toward the establishment of what he calls the global village. That is, we're going to, according to him, overcome all these separations, neuroses.
We're going to implode. Isn't that one of his words?
That's right.
Implode.
That's right.
Now,
we're going to implode, and we're going to be much better off.
Now, how does this work? How does this television, which has been again and again opposed as being an essentially subversive medium as far as culture goes, how is it going to reestablish
to go back to another theory of McLuhan. All the people who attack television and all of the people who defend it talk about the contents of programs. That is, for example, Batman or Westerns.
Versus documentaries
and conversations about McLuhan. Westerns are supposed to be bad for you. The conversation about McLuhan is supposed to be good for you. To McLuhan, this is all nonsense. His basic slogan is, the medium is the message. You are affected by the form of television, not by what's in it. Now, that's a rather difficult thought. It doesn't make any difference what programs you see. The thing that extends your senses is the fact that you are now looking and listening instead of just reading.
Yes, you're getting a different amalgam,
exactly.
A different sensory formula.
That's it. And that is what is broadening your consciousness and qualifying you to be a member of a global village.
The global village. We're all squatting in our little grass huts in the global village, looking in the people.
Yeah. Now, this idea that the medium itself is the message, and McLuhan is very good at an aesthetic analysis of the different media. Take the comic strip and the boxes in the comic strip. He very carefully distinguish that type of color which you get on this newsprint, which creates a kind of blurring image from, let's say, a woodcut or a well-made color lithograph. This is has a kind of blurry quality, and he compares that box with the television box. Now, there again, he's not interested in what goes into that box any more than he's interested
in just in the capacities of the medium.
Now, this idea sounds obscure, but it's not an unfamiliar idea in literary criticism. For example, T.S. Eliot said many years ago that the form of the sonnet, that is, it's having 14 lines broken into two parts and moving according to a certain rhyme scheme,
yes,
has in itself a meaning which a good sonneteer opposes to what he says within that form.
Yes.
Now, McLuhan, who's, as you know, a student of literature, and particularly very involved with modern literature, with Pound, Joyce, Eliot, undoubtedly absorbed this idea that the medium is the message from the so-called formalist tradition.
Yes, Eliot, for example, says that the poet takes the meaning into the poem like the burglar brings along a piece of meat to give to the dog, so that the intellect has something to chew on while the emotions, meanwhile...
McLuhan said that.
Yeah, well, Eliot, I think, originally. Probably quoted it. McLuhan quoted
it. I don't think that Eliot would have used such a homely image. This is much more like a comic strip image, the one burglar with the, you know, misleading the mind,
yeah,
like a... with a piece of
meat. All right, we'll look it up after the show. You want to make a bet there? Now, let me ask you this. If these media have distinctive properties, and I think we can go along with that, how is a medium, though, like television, which seems to be the most controversial one and one of the ones he performs on most brilliantly, how is this, what is this message? I mean, the medium is the message, but what is the message?
The message is that your whole sensory apparatus is being engaged at the same moment. That is, you're sitting in a room. You're watching something. You're hearing words. You may be hearing music. There's an environment created by this particular form of communication, which is not created, again, to go back to his point of departure, the book. You sit in a corner and read a book. That's it. There's a silence.
Passivity.
You're passive. That's right. You're inactive. Well, you're sort of inactive when you're watching television, too.
But doesn't he make a distinction between movies, which we, most of us, feel are analogous to television? Doesn't he make a sharp distinction between movies and television?
Yes, on the basis of the type of image you get. The movie image, he claims, is much more precise. The movie camera gives you a larger, more a sharply defined image, where the television image, being made out of all those dots, has a much more of a blurry character. I think that's one of the things that intrigues him, that what you're seeing is coming from afar very often. That is, in live TV, you are not getting a film of something. You're getting the thing itself raining on you through all those dots of the television screen, and of course those dots are much larger, more separate than the dots of a...
So it has a sculptural contoured...
Well, it's more like an overall abstract painting.
Like an abstract panacea pattern.
Yeah, and it has to do in his mind with what the sculptors now call environmental sculpture. That it tends to suck you in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has another set of categories or antitheses. It's what he calls a hot medium and a cool medium. The hot medium reaches out and grabs you. Now, he says radio is a hot medium. Mussolini or Hitler yelling at crowds, going through at you,
yes,
and grabbing you. And your tendency then is to retire. Now, TV, or the comic book, he regards as a cool medium. It sort of draws you toward it.
You have to probe it. It's ambiguous.
Well,
it sucks you in.
Let's put it that way. You don't have to do very much. It does things to you. Now,
I see.
Another factor in McLuhan's thought is that practically everything is a medium. In fact, I couldn't find anything in the world that wasn't a medium. I mean, a mountain is a medium.
Yeah, it's a universal metaphor.
So he talks about other cool media. For example, our open-work stockings. A girl walks down the street, open-work stockings have a kind of indefinite character, and so you're drawn to look at the legs or dark glasses. He said, now, the people walking around in dark glasses are attracting you through this cool medium.
Yes.
Well, if you carry this far enough, the world itself is a large system of communications. And as you respond to the world, or are compelled to, let's say, or the world is taking hold of you in this greater degree than it ever did before, you are actually being immersed in what used to be called nature. What McLuhan is doing is, quote, singing the body electric, only he's talking about it not as Whitman did in terms of metaphysics, but in terms of Charles Edison. That is, the electronic media are turning you into a body electric, which he is singing about.
Now, don't you feel that ultimately, though, his explanations come around to the point that we started from, that this will unfit people for traditional cultural activities, that the child who spent years and years watching television is going to come to reading less well equipped, perhaps, than
He regards this as a happy outcome. In other words, McLuhan is a futurist. If we can get rid of all that old culture, we will get rid of divided minds, schizophrenics.
Well, you're smiling while you say this, so obviously you don't agree with
him. I don't agree with him, no.
Yes. Now, what? How do you see it?
Well, first of all, my main criticism of McLuhan is that he's a utopian. He talks about the potentialities of change as if they had already taken place and as if they're irresistible. Consequently, there is nothing for you to do but to drift with this trend. You don't have to do anything in the moral sense. You don't have to further these matters. On the other hand, there isn't anything that you could do to oppose them if you should happen to have other views. So you are in a totally deterministic world, a determined world. Now, that's objectionable, I feel, because it's not true. There are always possibilities of moving in one direction rather than another. This aspect is ignored or eliminated by the media philosophy of history. Because what we're talking about is a philosophy of history, as you notice.
Yes.
We've gone from the book culture into
the succession of cultures.
Culture, and these sweep everything with them. There is nothing outside. I say this is objectionable, and it also had the character of making everything useless in a way. That is, as I said about these media, they actually use man as their instrument for developing themselves.
Yeah. Well, that's a formidable thought. Harold, I want to thank you very much for appearing on the program. And I think this is... Richard Schickel wrote a piece on Marshall McLuhan in Harper's Magazine this past November. At that time, he gathered a good deal of information about McLuhan, as well as carefully reading through his books, and also interviewed Mr. McLuhan. Dick Schickel has written two studies of the motion pictures, The Stars, and Movies, And he's also written a social history, The World of Carnegie Hall. A few moments ago, Dick, Hal Rosenberg was saying that a good many people were very troubled by McLuhan's use, for example, of the word media and the general ethos of his work, which seems to be sort of anti-literary. And I wonder if, in the course of your research before you wrote your piece, if you didn't pick up a lot of beefs from different people about McLuhan.
Oh, sure. There are understandable beefs about McLuhan. The most obvious one is this, that he seems to be predicting the end of literary culture and the beginning of a new kind of culture. Now, you can take a very almost Marxist view of that. The people who are literary see in him the trump of their doom, the end of the work they do. History seems to me to indicate that literary people have always reacted in this way to every new threat, including things that have, in the long run, worked to their advantage. The introduction of type, for example, or
but apart
universal
from that,
literacy.
Yes, I understand, and there is an element here, I'm sure, of the feeling of being threatened by an abstract historical force. But apart from that, which is a sort of self-interested reaction on their part, I mean, aren't there more or less legitimate complaints about the way this man writes or the way this man thinks or argues or fails to argue or something of that nature?
Sure. I think that McLuhan is himself, he says he uses language as a probe or as a drill, and he does. He's not a polished, logical writer.
Could you describe the way he writes? I mean, I think it's a very distinctive sort of
it's a difficult style to describe because it's initially very confusing. It is repetitive. He also goes off into tangents quite frequently.
Yes.
He latches onto a metaphor and then rings changes on it through 400 or 500 pages of writing, and the metaphor occasionally gets strained. It occasionally becomes inappropriate, in fact.
Now, I thought one of the best things in your article was at the end when you said that this man communicates perhaps best through conversation. And it suddenly struck me when I read that, that precisely that's what this is. This is the writing of a talker. A talker digresses, a talker repeats himself. A talker generally operates with level emphasis rather than building up to big crescendos. A talker often makes very abrupt
certainly,
transitions.
Certainly, and in a midnight bull session, as we
that's
know,
right.
We throw out ideas which are immediately discarded by the group. But McLuhan doesn't discard anything, and if you challenge him on an idea, he's just as likely to, instead of responding to you, bounce off into another idea, try it another way.
It's a sort of intellectual overkill, in other words. He just pours it out. He just spritzes it out all over the place, and if there's anything there you like, you can pick it up and put it in your
pocket.
That's
right.
And take it home. If not, you can...
As it happens, I think a problem here is that we value, because of some of the things that Harold Rosenberg mentioned, we value the print culture, the linear structure of an argument,
But I mean, these aren't just aesthetic preferences.
No, but
I mean,
what I'm getting at is that this McLuhan does not write in this fashion, and so he's easy prey and fair prey very often.
Yes.
To someone who says this stuff has no logic, this has no build,
proof.
No climax, the proof is weak, is anthropological evidence is, to my mind, though I'm not an expert, pretty dubious. It kind of is off the same cloth as Rousseau's anthropological
that's another interesting,
noble savage.
Yes, another interesting idea you had about Rousseau, because Rousseau is that type of pure intellectual who just picked up whatever
sure.
he needed to prove his case. And
what I think is most important to do in talking about McLuhan or thinking about McLuhan is not to try and make of him a system builder, a Marx, anybody like
right,
that. What you must do is in this vast body of this particularly understanding media, there are, I think, a dozen extraordinarily fine insights into the electronic culture, which, whether we like it or not, exists, is here. And I think if you pick and choose amongst them, your mind will, in fact, be changed by McLuhan. He gives you what we have not up to now had, a way of looking at, in particular, the electronic culture, and in most particular, television. What I would like to see happen is a kind of practical criticism taking off from some of these insights of
and
McLuhan,
working them out in more detail.
And working them out. In other words, I find it it is inappropriate to television, and I think also
how do you mean ineffective? I don't understand that.
What I'm saying is that what I was getting at is that it's inappropriate to television to continually harp on its failures of content.
Mm-hmm.
We've had the literary intellectuals and the daily newspaper television critics. It isn't even a medium subject to criticism in the usual sense of the word. Now, these people have harped away at content, and all that's happened, of course, is that content has gotten worse and worse over a decade. And I think perhaps it's time to start seeing it as something quite different.
Well, now, do you feel
as an environment to use?
I see, but this is one of the things that troubles me, Dick. Do you think, looking at it as he looks at it, that that enables you in any way to make it better? I mean, hasn't by the very
well, it won't exacerbate you quite so much. Put it that way. In other words, you can live with it a little more comfortably.
Now, that I think is a very interesting point, because what you're saying is that having rationalize this thing, having found an intellectual envelope to put it in, it doesn't have to trouble us or, as you say, exacerbate us any longer.
Yeah.
But maybe it ought to be exacerbating. Maybe it ought to be an open sore. I mean, maybe he is really, in a way, without intending to do so, becoming an apologist for a kind of culture that really ought to be opposed, challenged, and perhaps reformed.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think that... I don't think cultural history proceeds in that fashion. In other words, opposition is fine, but the truth of the matter is that technology isn't outrunning us at this point, outrunning our tools of understanding and therefore dealing with it. I confess, I myself have no way of practically applying McLuhan's theory
and
to the current product of television,
he
and he himself has not spoken to this, and I think this is another defect.
Mm-hmm.
I think that McLuhan has not deeply immersed himself in television, its practical and technological aspects, or in its total effect. I don't think that repeated exposure to television is necessarily going to soften our minds. But I'm just guessing. Thus far, it doesn't seem to have softened the minds of any of my friends any more than the movies did. And the same argument was, after all, applied to the movies. It was going to destroy this precious thing, the theater. Well, it may have hastened its to its present low state, but people go on writing plays and plays of quality. I think there is. What we've got to do is find some sort of a balance.
At least we have to have a handle to get a hold of the thing if we're going to deal with it at all.
Right, and I think he offers a handle which, let's say, Jack Gould does not offer in his daily column.
Or
Maria Manis.
Yeah,
with
or even sociologists and people
exactly.
like that. They haven't done a good job on writing about television at all. Let me ask you this. There is one often hears a McLuhan cult. Now, did you encounter this kind of thing?
Yes, there is a cult, and I think...
Now, why would there be a cult? I mean, this is not a writer who is certainly very accessible.
No, which probably helps to make him a cult.
Uh-huh.
But more to the point, I think that, and I said in the piece, that we have a couple of movements that we've all discussed. Camp is one of them, and
pop art
is another.
Yes.
And I have a feeling that he came along kind of by historical accident at a moment when people were seeking to rationalize their interest in these matters and to give them indeed a philosophical base. And McLuhan does, or at least seems to, offer that base. If you look at a piece of pop art and then say to, well, the medium is the message, you have no longer have any bothersome questions about content of that. That's the message, that piece of pop art. Similarly with Camp. Now, McLuhan, when I interviewed him, had never heard of Camp, oddly enough. This is what I mean. He's a little bit rarefied sometimes. He'd not heard of it, thought it was interesting, and was going to look up some articles on the subject when I left, and I assume he has. But I think that there has been a feeling of inadequacy, the same feeling that I had, which made me respond with some enthusiasm to McLuhan when I kind of stumbled across him. There has been a feeling of this cultural elitism of Dwight MacDonald, this snippiness of, about popular culture on the part of Mari Manis, while it's often amusing, somehow doesn't seem to speak to the point. The television goes right on being bad, so on and so forth.
Sort of a specious condescension. It doesn't.
Right. It's a lot of fun and games, and it's the easiest thing in the world, which is to take an attitude toward television. And I thought that McLuhan at least was wrestling with some real issues in his discussion of the mass or electronic media, whatever you want to call them. Yeah. And that's what I think is the most helpful thing.
Yeah. Well, Dick, I've enjoyed very much speaking to you this evening here on the show, and I want to thank you very much for joining us. Tom Wolfe needs no introduction to a New York audience. His pieces in the Sunday Herald Tribune have established a new vamp for journalism. In fact, that's what they call it now, the new journalism. And last spring, those pieces were collected in one of the most long-winded titles of all time, sort of marathon title, The Candy-Colored Tangerine Flake Streamlined Ever-Loving Baby. And I was thinking, when we invited Mr. Wolfe on the show for this evening, whether he wouldn't like to talk about McLuhan first. As a fellow spirit, tell me, Tom, do you see a connection between yourself and Marshall McLuhan as fellow explorers of out there, to use your phrase?
Well, I really do. In fact, I started feeling a connection in a very practical way one day. I picked up a copy of McLuhan's Gutenberg Galaxy at the behest of a young lady who already had that cult feeling that one tends to get about Marshall McLuhan. And I was getting ready to write a story up in New York, and this was specifically about Ann Dean's on 59th Street.
Oh, yes.
And so I read a little bit of that, and then I also had, just by happenstance, happened to have lunch with McLuhan since he was in town, and we talked a little more about it. And suddenly I found an insight into writing about discotheques, which was this, that the discotheque appeal was a kind of non-drug high that people were getting because of something that this kind of sound was doing to their senses. McLuhan put it,
it was a contact high.
A contact high.
Contact
yes,
high, yeah.
As they say, those people who
yes.
deal in such things. He said that going to a discotheque was like crawling inside of a jukebox.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of actually seeing a spectacle, you're actually getting inside of a jukebox, and a number of other things about aural sensation, A-U-R-A-L sensations. And suddenly, my little researches into discotheques bore him out in a very real way, which was to say that when I went to Ann Dean's and started asking them about their sound equipment, I found out that indeed they had loudspeakers on the ceiling directly above the dance floor and on the walls behind the band even, because they used both the record players and live bands from time to time.
Yeah.
And they had sound coming from every direction. In other words, people were getting absolutely bombarded in sound. They were crawling inside of a sound cocoon. And it was very much what McLuhan was saying about
a total environment
of sound.
He's
crawling inside of a jukebox. Now, the people who run on Dean's had not read McLuhan, and they had not read any advanced texts on sound engineering or anything. And they just knew that somehow this kind of sound envelopment worked. It did something to the senses. So I wrote that piece really out of a McLuhan point of view without having really...
Out of McLuhan contact high.
Of a McLuhan... yes, yes, we've got to get off these contact highs. But it worked.
Yeah.
And I think it was quite legitimate. Then I sat down and really started reading Marshall McLuhan. As I did, I found that he was explaining a lot of things.
He was explaining a lot of things perhaps from his angle, which had been things you had been probing from yours, exploring from yours.
Well, I've been finding all along, I mean, I've been dealing with things like stock car racing, Las Vegas, and rock and roll record manufacturers and producers,
yeah.
And girls of the year like Baby Jane Holzer and this sort of thing. And the thing that had fascinated me in all of these subjects was that there's a new kind of expression going on in the country that really has very little to do, whole new art forms, as a matter of fact, that have very little to do with what we academically have thought of as new expression, because when we've talked about new expression in the past, it's usually been something that comes out of an avant-garde atmosphere that in one way or another can be traced back to universities,
right,
or to aristocratic patrons
or former art movements.
Right, right. The kind of thing that you don't get any farther away from the academy than the saloon that's maybe 10 blocks away
across
from
the street.
Cooper Union or something like this.
Right.
I felt that there were people, we can almost not use the term working class or ordinary people anymore because it doesn't really mean much. They have too much money for one.
That's right.
That they were doing things that they always would have done if they had had the money. Now they have the money and they're doing it. Well, somehow the normal academic treatises don't explain that, and because it goes into an area that concerns itself with people who watch television all the time or who are live in a sound world, who have transistor radios plugged into their skulls, who have radios on in their cars all the time, or who are in the world of neon and electricity and so forth.
They're inside
and
it.
It's not enough to sit back and say, we're above this, which is what people have been doing. I mean, the New York literary establishment is past master at this. They've been sitting in parlor floor brownstones now ever since World War II.
Ever since Henry James.
Ever since Henry James, right. And saying that nothing has happened since then. Well, McLuhan is one of the few people who's been trying to find out what happens when you build up a world, an electronic world, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you something that has a, vaguely personal character, but which I think may bear this out. You were, by training, a Harvard PhD, is that correct?
Yale PhD.
Yale PhD, that's drastic. That's it. And in American studies,
right,
and so forth. Now, I have a sort of notion that today there are a number of highly trained, academically proficient intellectuals who are sort of eager to kick over the traces and discover a new world for themselves. In fact, this is a tradition. There have always been, the wandering scholars and the guys who sort of kicked the establishment thing and went out and discovered a new world, frequently a world of a rather lurid and common sort. I mean, De Quincey and Hazlitt, people like that, writing about boxing matches and writing about Saturday night markets in London and all that kind of thing. There really are a lot of precedents for this. And in earlier years of the present period, people like Seymour Krim kicking around up in Harlem and so forth. Now, I wonder, did you find, for example, that there was something in your life that sort of propelled you out of this academic orbit and into out there? Is there something?
Well, several things did. Some of them merely personal, but also the fact that after you sat in the stacks in the Yale Library for about 3 years looking at two little metal rims in front of you, which are two shelves full of books up in the cowl on the inside of the Sterling Memorial Library, you know that there's something out there.
something is missing, right?
Every now and then you'd hear someone that we used to always, whoever it was, we'd refer to as Maggie, a girl of the stacks, would be a girl from town who was putting the books away.
Yeah.
So you knew at least that Maggie, the girl of the stacks, was there, and there must be something else.
She was going back to it, right? Whatever it was. Now, a lot of people, I think, are resentful of McLuhan, not simply because he threatens us with a new world which is different from our own, but because they feel that he's sort of cashing in on something. I mean, not deliberately, but he is inheriting a sort of desire to exploit intellectuals or artists or new theories or new fads. As a journalist, do you find that there's a tendency to pick up on him and use him now as a journalistic property?
I don't think that many people have used him in the sense that I freely admit that I've used him. In other words, I've tried to use his theories insofar as I find them applicable. I mean, there are plenty of things that I sort of disagree with him on.
Well, what would be some of the things you disagree with him on? I mean, you're out there, so what do you disagree on?
Well, I think that in many cases has a tendency to do something that I remember very well from my graduate school days, which is to find a kind of synthesis that really isn't necessarily there. I'll give you an example. He will say that, for example, that Russia is an air-oriented society and the United States is an eye-oriented society.
Yeah, that's right.
And he'll say that this accounts for the fact that the Russians, being an Ir people, were absolutely shocked when the United States flew the U-2 over top of the Soviet Union for visual spying. The idea that these eyes were focused down on the Soviet Union outraged them. Conversely, that the United States, being an eye-oriented people, the United States was outraged when the microphone was discovered inside of the American Eagle in the American Embassy in Moscow. And that the implication being that if the U-2 had flown over the United States, we'd say, well, that's just the way we do things. We just look, and that the Russians wouldn't mind a few microphones.
Well, it's cultural, yeah.
This is falling prey to one's own ability to make this kind of synthesis and insights.
Yeah.
I think he tends to make these tremendous leaps this way. As a matter of fact, I think everyone is delighted with both.
Yeah.
I think that secretly, I'm sure that the newspapers in both countries had a hard time keeping a straight face over either exploits, you know, a microphone inside the Eagle.
That's really...
Well, they've got this plane up there that can look down into...
Terry Southern sabotage. It's that kind of thing, huh?
But I think, despite the fact that he will take these tremendous leaps in logic, which don't really make any sense, that you have to keep in mind that, more importantly, intellectually, in the academies, we're still operating under really a kind of... Ptolemaic theory. Who was the fellow that said that the Earth was the center of the universe? We still seem to think that man is the center of the universe, and we still operate out of an idea of romantic agony and this kind of a kind of individualism that we can't intellectually afford anymore. Because I think it seems quite feasible to assume that there are such big things affecting our senses, like radio and television and so forth.
One of the troubles that I have, and I'm one of these members of the Academy you're referring to, of course, is that I myself don't believe that professors and people of that ilk are really so out of it anymore, but I do feel that they would like to see these, as they view them, marginal values connected with some of our more central values. And it seems to me one of the problems of your own work, Marshall McLuhan, Susan Sontag, and others, is that while you have revealed this new territory, you seem to be a little too defensive about it. You're sort of fencing it off and saying, well, now it's over here, and I don't want you to come in and muck it up with your heavy, thick-ankled academic boots here, you know what I mean. But I'm not at all sure that there really is that desire to squelch it. I think it's more a feeling of, well, these things are delightful, but where do they fit in, and how hooked should we be on them? You see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I really don't feel that way about the Academy. In a number of pieces that I have written, and in a number of other pieces that have been written in our magazine, the Herald Tribune, have used sociological theory as a real guiding line, and quite directly, particularly things by Max Weber and W. Lloyd Warner on the subject of status.
Yeah,
and they've proven very useful, and I personally think that thinking in the academies, especially when it comes to the whole field of communications, literature among them, and art among them, well, not so much art, literature, the academy is far ahead of the people who are well-known in the fields. I think that's quite true. I don't think there is a...
How do you mean that again? I don't quite see that.
Well,
the academy is ahead of the people who are actually involved, let's say, in the mass media.
Well, I think when we think of literature, for example, we think of certain critics in some of the small magazines, particularly around New York, as being
literary intellectuals.
Well, they are completely 19th century figures now.
Mm-hmm.
I think the kind of thing that is done, not necessarily in the departments of literature, but in the departments of sociology and various departments that might be lumped under communications, are much more valid. I think Rudolf Flesch, for example, who is much maligned, probably in and outside of the academy, is far, far ahead as a thinker.
Yes, one of the things that bothers me, though, is that in order to establish, let's say, a new truth, you have to almost caricature it, or you have to do it in such an exaggerated or irresponsible way. You see what I mean? I mean, what is there? Is there some kind of a split there that these two things just can't be done in harmony or tandem?
Well, there's one rather unfortunate thing that's happened, and I'll get back to Rudolf Flesch on this. Rudolf Flesch, of course, has written Why Johnny Can't Read and a lot of other things on the art of readable writing.
Right.
This all comes from a dissertation he wrote at Teachers College on what makes certain kinds of writing readable and others not readable. Well, at the conclusion of his dissertation, which later became, mind you, one bestseller after another in another form, he said, after reading this solemn dissertation on readability, you may wonder why this dissertation itself has been so unreadable. And he said, this is because I want a degree. And if it were written in any other tone, I wouldn't get one. Well, now,
I see.
Unfortunately, I think both inside the academy and out, there's a lot of
translation going on.
A lot of people still expect a certain kind of tone.
Yes, I understand you.
If they're to be taken seriously, or they expect another tone if it's supposed to be entertainment. I don't see why these lines have to be drawn. And I don't see why a person... One day somebody came to me and said, you seem to use all kinds of devices in writing. So do advertisers. If you saw something on a billboard that they seem to get through to people, would you use that kind of language? And I said, sure.
If it works.
If it works, why not? And I think the same thing goes for ideas. Why?
Well, McLuhan himself often uses sort of jivey language or slang or jargon or anything that comes to hand. Is that the way he talks? I mean, you've interviewed him. You spent really a good bit of time with him. What is your impression of him? Is he really in his books, or don't they really reflect what he is fully?
Well, he's pretty nearly like his books. He is really, he really has a monomania in the sense that he feels that he is in a great terra incognita, and that the only thing to do is just to keep plowing ahead. He keeps talking about making probes. And he really, in effect, he says, I don't have time to argue with you.
I see.
There's so much unknown
keep
territory,
digging.
We've got to keep going. McLuhan, in one sense, is intellectually arrogant because he will not argue with people who disagree. But personally, he is far from arrogant. And actually, in the scholarly sense, he is not arrogant. He bends over backwards to give credit to people from whom he has drawn ideas. I mean,
yes.
He just does this kind
of... A lot of his books are almost a pastiche of quotation, aren't they?
Right, and he takes great pains to let you know that he's not saying that he did all this
by
himself. But he does have this kind of quality of monomania, and I think that's one reason he picks up adherents so fast, because he is a very serious person without being arrogant face-to-face.
Yeah.
And I never will forget being in the offices of Howard Gossage, who was really his great... one of his great heralds in the West Coast. And there were about six or eight of us sitting in Howard Gossage's office with McLuhan sitting around a table. At that same time, over across town, I think in the Hilton Hotel, there was a big meeting run by Dr. Hayakawa, the semanticist. And this was a conference on general semantics with about 1,000 people there. And so someone asked McLuhan, what do you think of the Hayakawa conference? And so he said, well... I'm sure it's fine, he says, but what disturbs me is that by the time that you can find premises on which 1,000 people can agree thoroughly enough to come together, and the premises themselves are already obsolete.
And then it's all over. Very good. Well, thank you very much, Tom Wolfe, for coming on the show with us tonight. You've heard some of the Marshall McLuhan story. And in the weeks to come, you're going to hear a lot more of that story from Life magazine, from Time, where they may give him the ultimate accolade of a cover, and from Fortune, of the television stations, and so forth. In the pop-eyed ebullience of American mass journalism, the disquieting features of Marshall McLuhan will probably be obscured. And there'll be a great deal of talk about how stimulating this man is. On the other hand, the fact that he himself, in so much of his work, separating content from form, taking the moral and aesthetic values out of the study of these mass media phenomena, and generally acting as an apologist for them, these facts will probably be overlooked, and that is perhaps the most disquieting aspect of his work. For after all, the world of technology, with which many people feel threatened, is a threat that we have been faced with for many, many years. Again and again, we have survived such threats and will survive this one. But the ultimate danger is that the scholars, the intellectuals, and the people who are most concerned to explain these phenomena may, in that very effort to explain them, become entrapped by the phenomena and in themselves become a form of technology. Perhaps, though, when the mass media have finally launched this man into orbit, he's had a chance to inscribe a few circles up there, we'll see that there will be a light, delicate rain of enduring ideas, and the other thing will go round and round until we hardly notice it's there anymore. Good night.